Queridos hermanos y hermanas, dear friends, there are two major truths which run through the Christian tradition in all its different cultural, devotional, historical forms. Two major truths. First of all, the death and resurrection of the Lord, the event we believe became the defining center of human history, the ultimate measure of everything we do and say. We're surrounding this morning in our very central a reminder of that very truth, namely this sculpture by the artist Pomodoro in our midst. A stark reminder of both death and resurrection. The surrounding crown of thorns has the edges of the tines touched not in scarlet of blood, but the beginning of gold. Gift of the Holy Spirit, nails that are gold in our presence. So that one truth, it's right in our midst, death and resurrection of the Lord. Everything else is judged accordingly. But then the other one, the other truth, profound identification of the risen Christ with every single human being in the history of the world. And the focus of that truth moves then from art to assembly, as we look around at each other and say, each and every one of us are Christ. Truly, because of our baptism, and so our joys and sorrows, our fears and our hopes are part of the redemption of the world, and whatever we live with is what Christ lives with. Now, that sense of community is so profound that it's right at the heart of everything we call Catholic Christian. It's very biblical. It's Catholic. Community, call it church, call it assembly, is the means by which revelation comes to us. It's a means by which forgiveness is given to us. It's the other side of the truth. Two main truths. Against that background of our faith conviction, we hear the great parable of the final judgment of the nations. We've had two parables about end time the last 2 weeks. There was the parable of the wise and foolish virgins and the sorting out between them because of their preparation for the arrival of the bridegroom. And then last week we had the parable of the talents. And so those serve to prepare us for today. Anybody knows that inevitably when I come to this parable, I always feel somehow a compulsive need to say a good word about the goats, because it seems to me they really do get bad press in this parable, and somebody needs to speak up for the goats. They were separated because they needed care daily in order to provide the dairy products for the community. The sheep could be set aside till shearing in the fall, but the goats were set aside because they were important and they were necessary. As a matter of fact, even the Paschal lamb, we are told in Exodus, could be taken from either the sheep or the goats. Didn't matter. It seems that it was simply a handy metaphor for sorting things out. From my agricultural, from a daily experience of the shepherd sorting the sheep and the goats, everybody saw it, everybody understood that. It could have been wheat and chaff, it could have been all sorts of things. In our day and age, we'd have different examples of sorting things out. We may talk about the laundry. We may talk about winter and summer clothing, sorting it out, bringing it forth or packing it away. We may even talk about silverware, sorting out silverware when we come out of the dishwasher. You don't put them all in one place. You sort out the knives and the spoons and the forks. And as a matter of fact of history, the forks are the most recent development in our social etiquette. So, you know, there are many different metaphors. It was just handy to speak about sheep and goats without any aspersions on the goat. Some people will say that because of this parable, that care for the needy is the only thing we will ever be judged on, that nothing else really matters. In the last analysis, it's just how did we respond to the needs of others? And responding to the needs of others is certainly very important, but what we can't allow ourselves to forget is that while this parable is the end, the final statement of Christ's teaching in the Gospel of Matthew before the beginning of the Passion narrative, it began with the Sermon on the Mount, which had other things to say about what we as disciples need to do. The Beatitudes, the special teachings of Jesus when he said in the Sermon on the Mount again and again, the ancients said what I say. And repeatedly in that Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus emphasized was the internal intention that we bring to service to those in need. So it's not only important what we do, but it also is important why we do it, to sort that out for ourselves in honesty and some kind of recognition that the key to sin is or good conduct is what we intended to do. Intention alone makes the sin, even if we never get a chance to act out. Intention alone makes things the way they are. Former district attorney came to Cousin Center some years ago to talk to the staff. And the question was, what did you learn in 30 years of being district attorney for Milwaukee County? His answer was surprising and profound. He said, in all those 30 years, what I really learned was, we smiled, the sisters were right, he said. The sisters were right when they said, if you think bad thoughts long enough, you will do it. The sisters were right, that intention is somehow very important for our lives. So we come back to this parable. Conversely, said Jesus, the desire to do the right thing can bring grace to all sorts of human situations, even if they unfold in ways we never anticipated. The parable calls the world together and asks the world, each person, to look backwards. To look backwards. Probably every single one of us can look backward to some situation when, in retrospect, we did not do what was needed. I know I certainly can. Someone in desperate need, but we were confused, perhaps, or unsure, or trying to sort out possibilities, and suddenly we missed the opportunity. Much to our chagrin, later on we come back and say, I should have reacted differently, but I didn't, for whatever sorts of reasons. And I suspect, standing here, I suspect that when this parable comes into full play, that there will be some people who come forward, and I will have to say, I'm sorry. I didn't do what I could have done or should have done, but I didn't know what to do. Probably every single one of us has that kind of moment or other when we'll have the opportunity face to face to say, I'm sorry. But we know tales of saints, great saints, Martin of Tours, a soldier who cut his cloak in half to give to the shivering beggar and discovered later on that it was Christ who was wearing half of the cloak. So we have that reminder from our history of great saints, heroes of faith and charity, that we are asked to respond to needs somehow. And if we don't, well, that's our fault somehow, in some way. The problem with those condemned by the parable is not that they didn't realize the people asking for hell was really Christ, the Lord. The problem was they didn't respond to the need. It never crossed their minds that they should give to those in need. The blessed were generous. The condemned were not. Callous, if you will, until the very end when they're forced to look backwards and see the real picture, the whole picture, the truth. The Penn State tragedy has people looking backwards, realizing they didn't do enough that they could have done more for whatever sets of reasons. That maybe winning was more important than caring. I don't know. But it's a moment when everyone associated with that is forced to take a second look. There are moments of honesty in families when parents are confronted by what they did right and what they did not so right. Parents and children coming together to speak about things that have not been spoken about for a long time. As the eldest in my family, I used to tease my folks every so often, saying, "Well, you practiced on me." And they would smile and say, "You're right. We did. We practiced on you." In families, whether it's trivial, playful, or whether it's more serious, whether it results in a long-term lingering hurt and resentment, sometimes serious illness of parents can give us the opportunity to have those kinds of conversations that are simply reconciling, wonderful, and healing for everybody, because it's a moment of truth, and it's a moment of affection and care. The sexual abuse crisis in the church, in the archdiocese, even if all those involved did the best they could, or consulted the best authorities they could find, or tried to do the right thing, in retrospect, knowing what we know now, it wasn't good enough. And to be able to have the opportunity to say that wasn't good enough. And to stand before the risen Lord, identified with all the needy in the world, including those particularly needy, and to say, "We're sorry. Could have done better, should have done better. We didn't know. Or maybe we did and couldn't figure it out." So this is a moment, this is a wonderful moment, this Feast of Christ the King, not just to celebrate glory in some kind of triumphalistic sense, but to take a hard look at the reality of this identification between the risen Lord and those who are suffering and in need around us, and try to even things out in a new way, but also to recognize humbly before God that there are probably all kinds of things we're doing now, which in 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, people will come back and say, "Didn't you realize? How could you not understand?" And we will have to say, out of our own ignorance or confusion at this point, "Well, I don't know. We tried to do the right thing, but obviously we didn't." So we stand before this mystery of God who loves us into goodness. We stand before the mystery of God who wants us to recognize our limitations, our successes, our failures, everything healed by God's grace, and to know that the sign of the cross in our midst is an invitation to be transformed and to come to the fullness of the liturgical year with a recognition of what's important and how we are partners in making the world a better place, even in our mistakes.